We are in Perek Yud Beis. I hope everybody had, if not an enjoyable Pesach, at least an uneventful one. Hopefully enjoyable as well, but God willing, this will pass and not return. We concluded Yiftach's story. We had his burial in the city or cities of Gilad, I think we're done with him. We now have three short stories of Shoftim, Ibzan, Elon, and Avdon. And these combine with the two we saw back in Perek Yud in chapter 10, which was Tola and Yair. And just to refresh your memory from what we did there, you have certain common elements in all of the stories. The two that appeared in Perek Yud, and the three that show up here. The common denominators in all of these stories are that, first of all, we are told about the location of each shofet. We are told about the length of service of each of these shoftim, and we're told about their burial site. So when you look, you know, at what we're up to in Perek Yud Bet in chapter 12, and take a fast look at Pasuk Yud, Pasuk Ches, really, to start there, in sentence 8, we're told that Ibzan is from Beit Lechem, we're told that he judged Israel for 7 years, and we're told that he died, and we're told that he's buried in Beit Lechem. And then you move on to a loan of Zebulun, and you're told he's from Zebulun, you're told that he is a shofet for 10 years, and you're told that he dies that he's buried in the land of Zebulun. And then the next one is Avdon ben Hillel, HaPiratoni, so Piraton apparently is the place that he's from. You're told that he judges for 8 years, and that he is buried in Eretz Ephraim, Har HaAmaleki. I'm just getting a message saying my speaker is not working. Are you able to hear me? Anybody lose me here?
Yeah, but it's breaking up.
It's breaking up
a bit.
Interesting.
Now I can't hear you at all. Because if you muted yourself,
Hang on. All right, now I should be on and everything should be working. Are we okay? You hear me? I don't know. I'm getting a very odd message on here about it. I'm going to just see if I can start it again. Give me 1 second. So, again, you get this common theme in each of the three, where you get, that's not a theme, it's facts. Location, length of service, burial site. And that was true for the two that were in chapter 10, that were in Perek Yud as well. Not only that, did you notice the verb that's used for each of them? And if you look in Perek Yud Bet, right, in Pasuk Chet, sentence 8, Pasuk Yud Aleph, and then in Pasuk Yud Gimel, for each of them it says, Vayishpot. He actually served as a shofet. Not all of our shoftim actually had that word. Not everybody was identified as actually being shofet. Another common theme in all five of these, and that makes them really unique, is that there are no stories about them. This is who they were, this is where they lived, they judged X number of years, and that was it. Three of them, we're told about their children and their wealth, right? We had that with Yair previously, and here we'll see it with Ibzan and with Avdon. It's really, these are meant to be a group. And what highlights most of all the fact that these are a group, as opposed to some of the others, what really highlights it is that we have one other shofet who we saw earlier in this sefer who should have been in the set because he also had very little description. Do you remember who that was? It was very early on. Okay, go back to Perek Gimel, chapter 3, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31. This was right before Devorah, although we had some discussion about the timeline there.
Shamgar
ben Anat. So Shamgar should have been in our set. If in order to be part of our set, you have to be a shofet for whom very few details are given, Shamgar qualifies. He gets all of one pasuk. However, he doesn't look anything like these. It doesn't say where he's from. It doesn't say how long he's a shofet. It doesn't say where he's buried. It doesn't say vayishpot. On the other hand, it gives us a story. It tells us about his battle against the Plishtim. So what I'm trying to say is that the five who we have here are not all the same just by dint of the length of their story here. Because Shamgar has the same length, and yet he's not... he doesn't have these sorts of details. Something else is going on here. So,
okay,
yeah.
Wasn't Shamgar also during the time of Devorah?
So that was a discussion that we had back then about how exactly the chronology works with him and Devorah, because we said Bimei Shamgar as part of it, and the question was about Shamgar and Ehud and how they worked with Devorah. I'm not reopening all of that. But yes, there was some question about it. So when we talked about the first of these short stories of the Shoftim back in Perek Yud, before we started on Yiftach, I gave you a few answers. I noted for you Professor Yechezkel Kaufman and his idea that the mini shoftim, so to speak, these short stories, are about shoftim who played a different role. They're not like the big regional charismatic leaders, but instead they're people who communicate the Masara, they communicate the tradition, but they're not regional charismatic leaders with big stories. And that's one possibility, but we noted that there are weaknesses in that. For example, if you really wanted to do that, to show that these five are all like that, you should have put them all together. Why did you stick Yiftach in the middle? That doesn't make any sense. If you're trying to show me, we've seen big charismatic ones, and now we're going to see some who are not, put them all together. In the beginning, at the end, it doesn't make sense to have them sandwiched around Yiftach. So Kaufman himself suggests that the Shoftim, the stories of the Shoftim themselves, are recorded by different figures over time. Remember that Sefer Shoftim itself is credited to Shmuel as the canonizer of the book. But Kaufman suggests that maybe you have different people who are writing up the records of their lives and they emphasize different things. I don't think that's the meaning of saying that Shmuel is the writer of the book. You could say that Shmuel himself chose what to record differently for each one, but I think that that's hard. So if you take a look at the sheet that I sent out, and in case you don't have the sheet, I'm going to upload the sheet to the chat on the site so that those who don't have it will be able to download it from there. It'll just take me a second to call up on my computer in order to do that. Okay, it's uploading to the chat on the side, and it should be up there, so anybody who didn't have it before should be able to pull it from there. So, Rabbi Amichai Shoham offers the following suggestion in an article called HaShoftim HaKitanim. And again, as I think I've said before, calling them Shoftim Kitanim or Mini Shoftim is no reflection on their height. To be entirely clear. But take a look at source number one, where Rabbi Shoham brings the following. He quotes somebody by the name of Ya'ira Amit. I don't know who that is. But Ya'ira Amit suggests, HaShoftim HaKtanim Achen Mishtalvin B'Model Shel HaSefer. These small accounts of the Shoftim do fit the model of the book, in the sense that, and I'm going to read you my translation here rather than the Hebrew and my translation. The book includes seven cycles of sin, punishment, rescue. Right? The cycles that we've seen over and over again of the Jews doing bad things, getting punished, and Hashem saves them. Right? Most recently, we saw that with Amon and Yiftach. And the bold is in the original. The small shoftim mark the periods of quiet after the rescue. So, for example, one may see Avimelech's period as a punishment for Israel. Then Tola ben Pua in Perek Yud rescued Israel, and then began a period of 45 years of quiet. And this explanation exposes another message of the book. Even after the double collapse of the monarchy of Gideon and Avimelech, there is great significance to continuity of authority. Continuity of authority prevents devolution of the nation into sin, and only an interruption of this continuity brings about the sins of the nation of Israel before the days of Yiftach and before the days of Shimshon. If so, the Jews who sought a monarchy were right. For continuity of authority prevents devolution of the nation into a situation where each Israelite does what is right in his eyes. So in other words, what Rabbi Shalom is suggesting, and I guess quoting or building on an idea from this Ya'ira Amit, what he's suggesting here is that these mini shoftim are strong leaders who manage to counter the destructive impacts of people like Avimelech and Yiftach. So Avimelech, right, who murdered all his half-brothers and couldn't stop fighting with people until he finally was killed, causes tremendous destruction. But after Avimelech, you have Tola and Yair, and they put the brakes on it. However, at the end of Yair's time, the people do descend, and that leads into Amon attacking us, Yiftach saving us, but then again, Yiftach trails off into trouble at the end of his career, his fight with Ephraim and all that goes with it. And then after that, along comes Ibtzan, Elon, Avdon, and they manage to keep people in line so that they are distinguished as people who succeed in keeping the peace. That's another approach. You could also go back to an idea which I floated back in Perek Yud from Rabbi Rosenson. Is he on here at all? No, I didn't bring it on here at all. Who had the idea that that maybe there's actually a learning curve going on, or not a learning curve, but a learning process, meaning that you have leaders who want power and leaders who don't want power. And we'll see how that flows in the three that we're talking about by the end of this perek. You'll see what that's about. But let's look at the stories themselves and then come back to that. So, Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12, Pasuk Ches, sentence 8. We look first at Ibtzan. And the truth is that Ibtzan is going to take us a little while. Those who were at the Bayit on Shavuos a couple of years ago for the second afternoon when they did a series of shiurim before Mincha. So I gave one of the shiurim there. I talked about Ibtzan. And those who were there will likely remember all of what I'm going to say now. I still have some things to add, but I apologize for the things that you'll remember from back then. Take a look at the story. Vayishpod acharav es Yisrael Ibtzan mi Beit Lechem. Mi Beit Lechem, I should say. Ibtzan of Beit Lechem is next up to lead. Vayilo shloshim banim u'shloshim banos shilach hachutza u'shloshim banos hevi levanav min hachutz. So keep track of the 30s here. This is like that as I was going to St. Ives thing, right? Michael, you're British. He has 30 sons. He has 30 daughters who he marries off elsewhere, and then he brings 30 daughters-in-law from outside. Meaning, I mean, you could have said this a lot easier. He has 60 kids, 30 sons, 30 daughters. He succeeds in marrying off all of them. Wow. Okay? What else do you need to know? Vayishpod es Yisrael sheva shanim. He was shofet for 7 years, and then he dies, and he is buried in Beit Lechem. So, what catches your eye in this story?
He sent his daughter.
Yeah. Isn't that really... First of all, why did you tell me about these daughters and their marriages? Right? What exactly was your point in saying this? And saying, as Gerald notes, to be married outside. I mean, what does outside even mean? What was the alternative to outside? Sorry?
It almost seems like a trade.
Yeah.
He traded his $30 out and brought in, as a trade, 30 daughters for a son.
Yes. It has a sense of commerce to it, right?
Yeah.
You know what else is strange?
Trade.
Right. You know what else is strange, though? I take you back to a comment that we made about Gidon. Gidon, we said, had 70 sons. Right? That takes work. And I don't mean it takes work in terms of you know, raising them and tuition and whatever else. But you have to be doing this intentionally. You don't do this with one wife. Right? It means you married many more wives, and you are trying to accomplish something. And the same thing is true here. Iftson is doing something on purpose. I don't know what he's doing yet, but he's doing something on purpose, especially when you look at the balance. How in the world did you flip a coin 60 times and end up with 30 heads and 30 tails?
The other thing, is there any parallel to Yahir that had 30 sons that ruled over 30 cities? Like,
yep.
Is this a magical number?
So there's got to be an association between this and Yahir, who we saw in Perek Yud. Absolutely. So let's see what we can do with this. First of all, just point of information. Beit Lechem. So the Da Mikra edition of Shoftim, which I'm using, thinks that this Beit Lechem is not the Beit Lechem you're thinking of. It's Beit Lechem from Zevulun. We saw back in Sefer Yehoshua in chapter 19 that there is a Beit Lechem in Zevulun. He doesn't say why he thinks that. The Encyclopedia Mikra'it is a very interesting set of books. And actually, since I'm here, I can show it to you. Ha! An advantage. I'm not going to pull out the volume that we're talking about and show you an example of it. It's a very large set. That's the Encyclopedia Mikra'it. It's large physically, and there are a lot of volumes. So, in any case, the Encyclopedia Mikra'it thinks it's the Zevulun one because the next Shofet we're about to see is from Zevulun. So that's what leads him to think that. However, the Gemara very clearly believes that it's Beit Lechem Yehuda. Are you able to hear me? Because I'm getting a note again about my speaker. I'm getting some thumbs down. All right, I'm going to do what I did. Yeah. All right, then let's resume, so to speak. So the Gemara is going to clearly think it's Beit Lechem Yehuda, as we're going to see in a little bit. Professor Kaufman says it's Davka Yehuda. And I brought you his comment in source number 2. He says, because immediately after Ivtsan, a Shofet is explicitly identified as being of Zevulun, right? The very next Shofet we're going to see is Elon HaZevuloni. And it was told that he was buried in the land of Zevulun. So one may assume that Ivtsan is not of Zevulun, because otherwise you would have said it explicitly. The next one you're going to say is from Zevulun. So if Ivtsan was from Zevulun, you would have said that as well. The fact that you didn't say Ivtsan is from Zevulun leads me to believe that this Beit Lechem is the one that's more familiar to us. Beit Lechem Yehuda. Beit Lechem of Yehuda, which is better known than that of Zevulun, and therefore the text doesn't need to say it's Beit Lechem of Yehuda. That's my assumption. And he says, you know why the secular scholars don't think that it's Beit Lechem Yehuda? He writes, it's because they made a dogmatic assumption that Yehuda was separate from the other Shvatim. And therefore, it wouldn't make sense to have a Shofet who's from Yehuda, who is involved with the other Shvatim, with the other tribes. However, he says, that lacks any foundation. There's a whole discussion, which we're not going to get into, but I'll mention it because Kaufman mentioned it, of the relationship between Yehuda and the other Shvatim. There are points in this book that make it seem like Yehuda is separate from the other Shvatim. So, for example, when we do the census, the military census, later on, we will see Yehuda tabulated separately from the others. Nonetheless, he makes the point that that doesn't mean Yehuda is functioning separately, and it doesn't mean that you can't have a shofet from Yehuda. The same people who have a problem here have a problem with Othniel ben Knaz, the first shofet, who is also from Yehuda. So Kaufman doesn't buy it, I don't buy it, and I think this is Beit Lechem Yehuda, and the Gemara very clearly believes that it's Beit Lechem Yehuda, as we're going to see. So, what's with the marriages? So, normally, what do you read when you see marriages? Like, in these numbers or in general, when you describe the marriage of a member of the family of a shofet, what does that tell you? What is a marriage like that about?
Forming alliances.
Yeah. They're forming alliances, right? It's a political marriage. That's the way that this works. The 929 website has articles written by people of all different backgrounds. And when I taught Shoftim last time, I took a look at this story there, trying to see if anyone had any unique perspectives. And in number 3, I brought you a short line from a short piece by a woman by the name of Chanit Bartuf. She asks a question. How many wives did it take to produce these 60 kids? He for sure was polygamous. And yet, he marries off his sons to only one woman. What exactly... Sorry?
Maybe he learned from experience.
He learned from experience? Could be. Or maybe these, I mean, not to be glib or crass, but maybe these were starter wives.
Yeah, because he only had one per child. It just said he brought for a life purpose one per child.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. Maybe this was just one. It's just very funny that someone who was clearly polygamous, it says he brought 30 women from the outside to marry his 30 sons. You're right. It could be only one of their marriages was, in fact, a political marriage. There's something going on, and that's really what I want to get at here, is that there is some kind of a plan at work involving not only the kids, but the marriages that are involved. So what exactly is this, and why are you telling me about this in the book? So I'll give you two answers right now, and then we're going to come back to another one. Take a look on the sheet, please, at source number 4, at what Radak says. The Gemara is going to say, we're not there yet, but the Gemara is on the flip side of the sheet, that Ivzan is actually Boaz, as in Boaz from Megillas Rus. And we'll see why the Gemara says that, we'll get to that. But in that story, then, that means Boaz had these 60 kids. So take a look at number 4. My translation there. Our sages said Ibzan is Boaz. It appears to me that they said this because the text spoke of the marriages of his sons and daughters, and it placed Manoah beside this, meaning here you get Ibzan, who's got 60 kids and all of their marriages, and after we finish with these short stories of the Shoftim in our perek, the next perek is going to start us off with Manoach and his wife who have no children. So he says, to teach that one should not be arrogant due to his wealth or children. Ibzan made 60 feasts for his sons and daughters. And the Gemara is going to say, this is a terrible thing, we'll have to come back and explain it, that he loses all of them. So Radak says that what the Medrash is reading here is that one who has the bracha of having all these kids shouldn't take it lightly and shouldn't assume anything, and someone who has nothing should not be looked on for the nothing that he has because he can end up with a shimshon. That's that's one idea that's found in the Medrash. Then Radak says, in addition to that, I've got my own idea. He says, he uses a phrase that he likes to use. If you're following in the Hebrew, the end of the third line in the Radak, V'tov hu in Kabbalah haisa etzlam zeh. If that's their tradition, that's good. That's a phrase that Radak uses when he has a pshat explanation that doesn't match the Medrash. So then he goes on and says, according to pshat, the text spoke of the marriages of his sons and daughters to tell of his great success with his sons and daughters, for he married off all of them in his lifetime. In truth, there were good things about him, and as a reward, he achieved the success and the great stature of becoming a shofet of Israel. In other words, what we're doing by telling the story is not talking about politics and political marriages. It's simply trying to say, this was an amazing shofet. Here you have this fellow named Ibzan. Look at that. He had all these kids. He succeeded in marrying them off. He must have been an amazing man. So Radak has given us two opposite reads, right? One read is, it's telling us all of this in order to say, compare this with Manoach, and Ibzan is going to lose them all, according to the Medrash, and Manoach is going to get Shimshon. So don't put too much weight on it. That's the Medrash. And then Radak says, but I think, as a matter of pshat, the straight read is just the opposite. It's telling us that Ibzan really was an amazing guy. Abarbanel goes with the Medrash view, and he says no. Take a look at source number 5. He says, the text told the story to teach that it is a wheel which revolves. Right? A phrase that we use in the Gemara regarding the regarding poverty, that it is a wheel that revolves. Yiftach had only a lone daughter. She did not merit to marry, for since her father vowed she was consecrated for God and no man knew her, we spent time on that story before Pesach, and Ibzan judged Israel next, and he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, and he married that all of them married in his lifetime. So he takes an approach like the Medrash that Radak quotes, that it's meant to show you that, you know, some people get it, and some people don't. Are you with me? I don't want to lose anybody on this. This is just the beginning. The marriages are presented here in what looks like something political, and we're going to come back to the politics of it later on. That's coming below. However, we have this debate among the commentators whether we're looking at this story of all the wives as a sign of his greatness and his success, or whether we look at it as a statement of some people seem to have a lot and they don't, some people seem to have nothing and in fact they have something. But now we're going to come to the Boaz association. So take a look at this flip side of the page. Source number 6, Bava Basra Tzadi Aleph Amid Aleph. Amar Rabba Bar Ravuna Amar Rav. Rabba Bar Ravuna quotes Rav, saying, Ibzan is Boaz, just like we quoted. So the Gemara says, Mai Kamash Malan, what exactly is this teaching us? When you say Ibzan is Boaz, what is that? What's your point? So he says, it's like another lesson of Rabba Bar Ravuna, who said, citing Rav, Boaz made 120 feasts for his children. As the Pasuk in Shoftim here says, and he's quoting you the Pasuk about the marriages. How did he get to 120? For each child he made two feasts. One in his father's house, and one in his father-in-law's house. So in other words, he marries off his 30 sons. That's 60 feasts, and he marries off his 30 daughters, and that's another 60 feasts. At each feast he did not invite Manoach. He said, what will this childless mule repay me? He says, he's not going to invite me, I'm not inviting him. And we learned all of them, Rahmanul Islan, died in his lifetime. It is as people say, if you birth 60 in your lifetime, what are the 60 for you? Go have another child who's more energetic than 60. Don't stop at any point, even if you've got 60. Okay, that's the Gemara. And that's it. You're not going to get more evidence, you're not going to get more of a discussion. That's what the Gemara has to say. So let's break this down. Why in the world does our Gemara think Ibzan is Boaz? What's your evidence? You can't hear me, David? Can others hear me?
You're breaking up again.
That's weird, because the message on my thing that the mic wasn't working went away. Now it says that I'm fine.
No.
I just muted and unmuted. Now?
Yeah, better.
Better? Okay, so let's try this. I don't know. The last time I had problems like this was before Pesach in this year, so I'm hopeful that it doesn't happen too often. I've been doing it a lot since then. But what's the evidence to say that Ibzan and Boaz should be the same person?
You're breaking up again.
All right. Okay, sorry. So, again, what's the evidence for Ibzan being Boaz? What can you tell me? Sorry? So good. One piece of it is definitely Beit Lechem, because remember from Megillas Rus, right? That they are from Beit Lechem Yehuda. That was my reason for saying that the Gemara clearly believes that this Beit Lechem is the one in Yehuda, because otherwise it makes no sense. Right? So the Beit Lechem is common. What else? Boaz is not presented in Megillas Rus as just a guy. Boaz is presented as some kind of leader among the elders at the gate, which we associate with the Beis Din, right? Like the whole discussion when he wants to marry Rus, the Zakenim Ashavashar. So he is presented in a shofet type of a role, and add to that that the book begins, Vayihi Bimei Shofot HaShofetim. It was during the time of the Shoftim. That's the way Rus begins. So we know he's somewhere in this period, but not only that, he isn't mentioned in Sefer Shoftim. I thought Shoftim listed all the Shoftim, right? That was certainly Abarbanel's view. That was certainly Ralbag's view. The Gemara seemed to say that all the Shoftim are listed. So if Boaz is a Shofet, he should be here somewhere. And if I have a shofet from Beit Lechem, well, that's who it should be. Take a look at the Ralbag in source number 7 on the sheet. Ulefi sheboaz nira meinyano shaya shofet Yisrael v'haya mi Beit Lechem. From his story, it looks like Boaz is a judge. He's a shofet. And he's from Beit Lechem. V'lo nimtza b'shoftim zulas Ibzan shaya mi Beit Lechem. He's the only one who is from Beit Lechem. Ibzan is the only shofet who's from Beit Lechem. So our sages said, Ibzan is Boaz. This is correct. It's math. That's the idea that Ralbag presents. Add to that, the fact that Boaz is known as being very wealthy. He's got all those fields. And Ibzan is somebody of apparent wealth as well, based on our description here. The name itself is also very interesting. We talked about the names of these shoftim back in Perek Yud, right? Tola, we said, seems to be associated with Yisachar, right? Remember that? And we had Yair, which is an old name in the family of Menashe. And then Elon and Avdon are also names that we have in our past, specifically in Bereishis Memvav and in Bamidbar Chavvav. So Ibzan is the only name here of the five that isn't a name found in our history, suggesting that maybe that's not actually his name. Ibzan may not be his real name. People in Tanakh get renamed all the time based on the roles that they play in a story. Right? Yisro's got loads of names. Take a look at source number 8, Rashi and Divrei Hayamim. Unclear that Rashi wrote Rashi to Divrei Hayamim, but it doesn't matter for our purposes. The idea here is a Midrashic idea. Ibzan is actually a compound for Av Tzanun. Sanun, literally, is cold. He is Av L'chol HaTzinunim, the father to all those who cooled themselves off. What is he talking about? He's talking about the fact that Ivtzan doesn't do anything with Rus when he has that opportunity initially in the granary. He chills himself. He cools himself off. So the suggestion is, Ivtzan is not actually his name. Ivtzan is his trait. That's the idea. Now, it's unclear that you have to take this literally, that Ivtzan actually literally is Boaz. The Radak that we saw before clearly does not think that this is pshat. He says, if it's a tradition that Ivtzan is Boaz, fine. But if not, I'm going to go my own way. He has his own view. Radak is not sold on this idea. There's also a medrash in Rus Rabbah that very clearly does not think that Ivtzan is Boaz. It's a medrash in Rus Rabbah that talks about Ivtzan marrying off his daughters on the day when Naomi and Rus return to town. It doesn't fit with the Gemara here that it's Boaz and that Boaz lost all of these children. However, Rashi absolutely thinks that it is literal. Take a look at this at source number 9, that Rashi on Divrei Hayamim. The pasuk says, Salma produced Boaz. So he says, our sages said Ivtzan is Boaz, but this is shocking. How could it be? Nachshon died in the second year after the departure from Egypt. Salmon, his son, was already dead. There's a typo there. It should say his son was already dead. And he was of those who entered the land. Meskvar. Right, he's dead by this point. And he was from those who entered the land. And his son Boaz, Ivtzan, was born upon entering into the land. In other words, Rashi is looking at the generations. In order for it to work, that Ivtzan and Boaz are the same person. And he says, I don't see how that could possibly happen, because the generations that lead to Boaz are Nachshon, Salma, and then Boaz. And he says, it doesn't make any sense. He says, Salmon, the one in the middle, was among those who entered the land, and he has a son named Boaz who's going to be Ivtzan and is going to live all the way until now? Remember that Yiftach's time, we said, was 300 years after they entered Israel. That was what he said to Amon. He says it's an awfully long time to think that Boaz is now going to be 300 years old.
Pinchas can be this age.
But to have a child as well. So Rashi's solution is to say, you're right, and having a child was a miracle. My point in bringing this is not to discuss superannuated pregnancies, but rather to say to you that this Rashi on Divrei Hayamim clearly believes that the Ivtzan Boaz identity is literal. Because otherwise he wouldn't need to spend any time trying to work out the chronology. Ralbag, who we said before, also took it very literally and said that this is actually true, that Ivtzan and Boaz are the same. And again, we pointed out there's a lot of evidence to support it. We need a shofet from Beit Lechem during this period. Who else is it going to be Boaz? It makes sense. I want to point you to source number 10. Dr. Yael Ziegler suggests that we learn important things from identifying Ivtzan with Boaz. She writes, if Boaz is indeed Ivtzan, then we learn two important things about Boaz. First, we know that he has 60 children, which means he doesn't need to marry Rus for his own continuity. So she writes, I actually argue that that's not correct, because the same Gemara says that he lost all 60. I sent an email to the website where her article was posted asking about it. I have not heard back. This was a couple of years ago. Maybe I should try sending it again. But leave that aside. Keep on reading. While in the book of Rus we have no information regarding Boaz's family, the identification of Boaz with Ivtzan suggests that Boaz's intention in marrying Rus is completely selfless from the perspective of desiring progeny. This is very important to support my assertion that Boaz parallels Ruth, whose selfless behavior is the hallmark of the narrative. He's marrying her to take care of her. Again, I'm not so clear on that. But keep on reading. Second, this identification with Ibzan indicates that Boaz is not averse to external marriages. Remember the language. He brought in women from the outside to marry his sons. He married his daughters to the outside. He's not afraid of external marriages. He's not xenophobic. And that he would presumably be able to allow for a qualified foreigner to become part of his family. Boaz's identity as Ibzan prepares us for his own willingness to marry Rus later in the story. Despite the Goel's reservations, Plodi Almoni doesn't want to do it. I'll mess up my portion if I bring her in. Boaz has no such fears. This medrash launches our hope and expectation that Boaz will be the heroic solution to the problem of finding a husband for Rus of Moab. Okay. So, having said what we've said so far, that this identity has a logic to it, even if there's reason to question it somewhat in terms of the chronology, nonetheless, there's a lot of logic to support the identity. Let's go back to the other piece of the Gemara. The other piece of the Gemara was the part that said that he would not invite Manoach to his kids' wedding, since Manoach had no children, and therefore could not invite him back, and he got punished with the loss of his children, and Rus is the one who gave him continuity. What in the world is all of that about? What is the Gemara? Where does the Gemara get this from? What's the evidence for it? So I'll tell you what I think. Once you already say that Ibzan is Boaz, take that as your starting point. You need an explanation for why his kids don't show up in Megillas Rus at all. Boaz is on his own, right? He's out there with the workers who are working in the field. We never meet any of Boaz's children. If Boaz really has 30 sons and 30 sons-in-law, why is he managing the estate himself? That's number one. Number two, look at the language in Megillas Rus, and I didn't bring it here on the sheet. But remember the language that he uses with Rus. I'm actually going to call it up on here, and I'll share the screen with you. It's worth it to be able to see this. Hang on a second. I'm going to share... Right, but it presents him as doing things that we associate with being a chauffeur. Keep in mind that a wealthy man who is among the elders at the gate. I understand what you're saying, but keep in mind that even in Sefer Shoftim, not all the Shoftim are presented with that identity and with that title. Yes.
So they weren't of the same time frame.
So it's certainly true, and I think that supports Radak, that the chronology is hard to work with to support this Gemara. But I want to first show you why the Gemara says what it says before taking that route. I don't dispute your point. I just think that there are other things to see first. So, if you look at what I shared with you on the screen, specifically, Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud, when she goes to Boaz and she says, "You are my Goel, you are the Redeemer, you're supposed to marry me." Look what Boaz says. Brucha at Lashem Biti, you are blessed to God, my daughter. Heitav chasdecha acharon min harishon. Your latter chesed is even greater than your earlier chesed. Her earlier chesed was taking care of Naomi. Her later chesed is being willing to marry Boaz. But if he has enough wives and enough kids, like you've described, that doesn't make any sense. What's her chesed to him at all? So that's one piece that supports the idea that he has no children at this stage in the story. Then, if you take a look at Perek Dalet in Rus, the Goel says, I can't marry her because it would ruin my nachala, it would ruin my portion. Ga'alacha ata, you go do it. It suggests that, whereas Ploni Almoni has other kids and is worried about the impact, he thinks that Boaz need not have any such concerns. Why? Because Boaz doesn't have other kids. And then the last piece of evidence is in Psukim Yud Aleph and Yud Bet, sentences 11 and 12. I'm getting the message again about my audio. I hope you can hear me. In sentences 11 and 12, when everybody at the gate gives Rus this great bracha for building up Beit Yisrael, right? And that his house should be built up via her, it sounds like he doesn't have a house yet. It sounds like this is going to be what gives him a house. So the idea that he has no children, well, let's break it down into its components. The idea that Boaz and Ibsen are the same person, we've given its justification. The idea that Ibsen has no children at this stage, that he's lost the children he had before, is based on the fact that he seems to be childless here, and Rus gets this great big bracha for her chesed that she's going to give him children. But what we haven't supported is why you should say that he was terrible to Manoach. And the story itself is difficult. Howie pointed out one difficulty, the span of years in between them. But also, Manoach is living in Dun. Manoach is not an immediate neighbor. Granted that he is between Sarah and Eshtaol, maybe he's near Yehuda, but it's not like he would have been his next door neighbor. So it's hard to understand why we need to see Boaz in this negative light and pitch him as being harsh regarding Manoach. But we're running out of time, so I'm just going to present you two ideas. Number one, Rabbi Chaim Angel suggests that this is consistent with the Medrash in Vayikra Rava. If you take a look at source number 11 on your sheet, this is a classic Medrash. Michael, I know you. I saw your message that you're having poor sound here. I'm getting the warning on and off about my sound. It's not just Michael. It's a few others also. All right, I'm going to try one more time with the leaving and coming back thing.
Try to mute it first.
I tried that before. It didn't really work, but I'll try it again. I am muted. I am unmuted. Does that help at all?
Yes.
Okay, good. Let's see if we can get through this. So, the Medrash in source number 11 on the sheet mentions that Boaz, for all of his chesed, which we play up, he took care of Rus. What did he do? He says to her, you can go collect after the gleaners. Oh, and by the way, here's a lot of wheat you can take home yourself. Right? You've got workers. Why did you send workers with her? Better yet, as the Medrash says in source number 11, why don't you give her a golem betum? Give her fat calves. Why are you giving her wheat? She's going to have to bring back the wheat and grind it up. She has to trail after your gleaners all day in the fields. It portrays him as somebody who may be helping, but not so much. Not so much at all. And so perhaps that's a basis for the knock on Ibsen. However, I have another idea to work with. And we're not quite ready for it. But that Ibsen, we're going to portray Ibsen next week as a pragmatist. And we'll see how that fits with this portrayal of Boaz as well. I also want to note, okay, I don't want to end on this terrible note about Ibsen and Boaz. I want to note that there's a positive ending to this. There was a woman who heard my shiur on Shoftim when I talked about this a few years ago, and she added a note. I would mention her name, but I don't know if she wanted her name mentioned or not, so I leave it out. Her first name is Hadassah. So she heard the shiur, and she added, if Ibsen slash Boaz is condemned for his pragmatism and for his limited chesed, then taking care of Rus is his tikkun and his tshuva. Right? The fact that he marries her and ultimately does take her in shows some growth, which is why Naomi reacts with such joy. When Naomi hears that Boaz has given her food in the field, even if it's not fat calves, nonetheless, it shows that he's willing to help even when there's no apparent benefit for him. I thought that was an interesting note. I thought that was a nice idea. Whether there's really no benefit, after all, there's the chesed, he lost his kids. I'm not so sold. Nonetheless, I think that I think it's a nice way to at least end his story for now. What we've picked up today, out of everything that we saw, is number one, the way that these five brief accounts of Shoftim seem to be a set, the two from Perek Yud and the three from Perek Yud Bet, Tola, Ya'ir, Ibtan Elon, and Avdon, and they're different from Shamgar, who also has a brief story. We gave different explanations for why they are presented in this way, what the set is supposed to look like. We're going to come back to one more idea on it next week, once we've gone through the stories themselves. We talked about Ibtan, Beit Lechem Yehuda, gave a little bit about the marriages and why have these marriages. We're going to come back to that next week as well. And saw the Ibtan Boaz association with the evidence for it and with the arguments against it. We have a lot of loose ends. So you have to tune in next week to try to wrap everything up. What we'll do then, God willing, is see Elon. We'll see Avdon. And then go through the wrap-up idea, which puts everything together in terms of the set of five. And then, God willing, we'll start on the story of Manoach and Hatzlal Ponit, leading up to Shimshon. Okay? Thank you very much. Be well. Stay home. Have a good week.